F1 F2 F off back to Russia F off back to Russia F off back to Russia F off back to Russia
To Ebony Spectrum and in Black America here on WRCT Pittsburgh, WRCT.org.
Hey y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. Plane headed from Kansas collided with a military helicopter over Washington, D.C. 67 people died. There were no survivors. Passengers included top figure skaters from the U.S. and Russia, a young professor from Howard, a lawyer, and a young pilot. And you raggedy bitches blamed it on DEI? When discussing the crash, Trump cited old, outdated, and scientifically voided eugenics ideology when he said regarding the Federal Aviation Administration, we have a high standard. And there are things where you have to go by brain power. You have to go by psychological quality. That the various very powerful tests that we put to use to test employees were terminated by Biden. All this after generalizing Biden's diversity efforts by saying that he said FAA was too white. And it's clear to me, by the way, DEI is being weaponized in this current moment that the conservatives are trying to die on the hill that DEI is affirmative action hiring without any consideration of qualifications or fitness for a position. This is evidence again when just the day before the crash, 19 attorney generals sent a letter trying to bully Costco into abandoning DEI, warning them to stop their pushback after Costco has already said twice, girl, fuck you. In this letter, these attorney generals expressed the following: an urgency for Costco to end all unlawful discrimination imposed by the company through diversity, equity, and inclusion. Huh? That Costco should treat every person equally and based on their merit rather than based on divisive and discriminatory DEI practices. Divisive and discriminatory DEI practices is an oxymoron. And as I was reading this letter that cited the constitutions and the foundations of equality and all that jazz, it reads very clearly to me that what the government means by DEI and what Costco and the rest of us mean by DEI are two different things. A simple Google search revealed to me that on page one of their document outlining their commitment to DEI, it says that they strive to empower their workforce and strengthen their culture by creating an environment where all employees feel a sense of belonging, that they are accepted, included, and respected and supported because of who they are, regardless of who they are. Interesting. Then it goes on to say, it has always been Costco's policy that employees deserve an environment free of all forms of unlawful employment discrimination, that all decisions regarding recruiting, hiring, promotion, assignment, training, termination will be made without unlawful discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, ancestry, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, religion, age, pregnancy, disability, work-related energy, covered military or veteran status, political ideology or expression, genetic information, martial status, or other protected status. Mind you, this is the first paragraph. Their efforts to create an inclusive and respectful workplace include but are not limited to a chief diversity officer, conversation starters on topics like unconscious bias, microaggressions, allyship, and the like, giving these folks an additional holiday of their choosing, whichever applies to them, Juneteenth, Indigenous Peoples Day, or Veterans Day. They even offer a race-based breakdown of their workforce composition, and on both the management and non-management sides, it's still majority white, in keeping with the percentage of the white population in the United States. Crickets? Oh, okay. So my question is, how many attorney generals does it take to review a DEI policy? But oh, we can only make sense out of nonsense if they were being earnest in their claims to halt race-based discrimination. Do you know they told Costco that instead of worrying about DEI, they need to worry about the slave labor in China they've been accused of doing? I know y'all lying. Not when a man known to use slave labor in the Congo was standing behind a podium on Inauguration Day, and a man who used exploitative labor to ensure America's benefit from two-day and even same-day shipping was right beside him. JP Morgan Chase also said no, and y'all don't seem to be on their asses. I wonder why that is. Now, of all the people that did buckle under pressure, Target is the most surprising to me. And that's only because we burned their shit down twice over police killings in 2020. And the CEO stuck beside us even then. Y'all been partnering with and uplifting black business owners, products, and influencers, standing on business for years, and all of a sudden you just want to pull the rug out from underneath us? And y'all mad at Tabitha Brown? Yeah, she's got Donna's hair care, but the majority of her products are Target and or Walmart online. What, you expected her to have a contingency plan? Would she find it at the same time, the same way we did? Yeah, we can boycott because that sounds cool. That sounds revolutionary. But these things take time and effort and evaluation of how they will affect our people and our communities that rely on these resources. Yes, I know that's how it works. I know they are counting on us to be dependent on them, but they are not counting on us to play the long game and create avenues to ensure every individual in our community is able to sustain efforts of resistance. There's also more than one way to skin a cat, people. We can boycott Target altogether, sure. Or we can only purchase minority-owned products from them, creating a flux in supply and demand that would severely impact the health and stability of their business. However, still, black people only make up 15% of the population, so it's got to be more than us. Everybody affected has to lean in, and we have to do it together. The steamrolling is scary, and it seems to be relentless, but it is slowing down, so do not be discouraged. Give the people and yourself an opportunity to adjust and resist.
That was Lene Vinay with her commentary, her weekly commentary, and she is now on Instagram in case you're looking for her. She's not on YouTube right now, but she's on Instagram now. Next up, we have something from Native Land Podcasters.
A special and sad edition of Native Land Pod. I am your host, Angela Rye. Shout out to my hosts, Tiffany Cross and Andrew Gillum, in their absence today. But you all will be hearing from them, I'm sure, very soon on some solo pods. We're trying something new where we are going to do a side pod or a solo pod when there are issues that are pressing that we just want to get in front of you and make sure that we're in community with you talking about what's going on. So we are on YouTube Live, and I want to talk to you all about this memo that came from Matthew J. Vaith, the acting director of the Office of Management and Budget. Everyone is knowing is aware of this right now by the federal funding freeze. And let me tell you what's not frozen: your tax payments. They are still expecting your taxpayer dollars to fund these initiatives. And I want to go into just briefly what this funding freeze is calling for. And first, let me make sure my laptop is plugged in so I don't lose y'all along the way. here's the thing. We should talk about what Donald Trump actually has the power to do and the power that Donald Trump is going to test during his presidency. We will talk about what is at stake with this potential funding freeze, what is being asked of different agency heads, cabinet secretaries and officials, et cetera. And we'll talk about the potential violation of the law. If there is time, we will get to a few other executive orders, which also may be of importance. I'm telling our producer, Lolo, I forgot to call her, so she should just make sure that she texts me just in case there's anything she wants to flag. So I first want to just mention that we will be doing these lives pretty regularly, at least every Tuesday. So you will hear from us on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday for sure. We're working through a Wednesday and Friday option as well. Now, this is the memo, okay? This is the memo we're looking at. This is from the Executive Office of the President, Office of Management and Budget Control, Management and Budget. Here's what you all need to know. There is broad sweeping authority that OMB, that's what Office of Management and Budget, has. In this memo, the acting director, because Donald Trump's nominee has not yet been confirmed by the Senate, the person who will be confirmed by the Senate most likely is a man named Russ Vought. And he is a prior OMB director. And it is very, very chilling. And let me tell you why. You know that podcast we did on what is Project 2025? And you know how a lot of folks were blowing off this whole idea of Project 2025? Well, the thing is real. And it was sworn in on Martin Luther King Day. And he is controlled by many parts. This is Stephen Miller's White House. Donald Trump is not running this thing. His deputy chief of staff for policy is. And you remember how Donald Trump tried to distance himself from Project 2025. And he even put out his own thing, the Agenda 47, right? Well, let me tell you something. Project 2025 is coming to fruition every single day. Russell Vought, who wrote the chapter about OMB and Project 2025, is who Donald Trump is seeking to confirm for OMB. Now, this is what I want to tell you that he says on page 20. So you guys can fact check me. OK, on page 20 in Project 2025. They quote Russell Vought as saying OMB should establish a reputation as the keeper of commander's intent. Yet OMB is dominated by career employees who often try to overrule political appointees serving in the various executive departments. Empowering political appointees across the administration is crucial to a president's success. Now, what does that have to do with this federal funding freeze today? Well, this is putting the power back into the hands of Donald Trump's political appointees. So this is how this memo starts, because a lot of you are reading the articles, but you aren't necessarily seeing what is in the actual document. So it's a short document. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there's a couple of points I want to share with you. It starts with, the American people elected Donald J. Trump to be president of the United States and gave him a mandate to increase the impact of every federal taxpayer dollar. They go on to say that the federal government spends nearly $10 trillion $10 trillion in fiscal year 2024. And more than $3 trillion of that was for federal financial assistance, such as grants and loans. They go on to kind of demonstrate why the loan money, why the grant money that has been spent in this $3 trillion number should be reviewed. This is what they say that I think is important for you all to know. Financial assistance should be dedicated to advancing administration priorities, focusing taxpayer dollars to advance a stronger and safer America, eliminating the financial burden of inflation for citizens. I think we generally agree with that. Unleashing American energy and manufacturing. Let's talk about what they mean by unleash. There's an executive order for that, by the way. Ending wokeness. We don't even say that no more. But ending wokeness and the weaponization of government. You know what they mean by that. Read between the lines. Also read the executive orders that support that language. Promoting efficiency in government. That's that DOGE entity that Elon Musk is running. And making America healthy again, which is where they hope to put RFK Jr. So this is the thing. They go on to say the use of federal resources to advance Marxist equity, now striving for equity, equality, and justice is a Marxist concept. Transgenderism and Green New Deal social engineering policies is a waste of taxpayer dollars that does not improve the day-to-day lives of those who we serve, they say. Now, y'all, they have mastered weaponizing our language against us. The Green New Deal is to preserve the planet for folks who look like me and you a little longer. The Green New Deal is about ensuring that Flint has clean drinking water. When they talk about transgenderism, we're talking about making sure that all humans have access to resources and the ability to survive, regardless of whatever identity you claim. And then Marxist equity, again, we're talking about the policies that began to really take root and take hold after George Floyd was murdered on camera for 9 minutes and 30 seconds. Many of us thought for the first time in our Black lives, our brown lives, our indigenous lives, or whatever lives, maybe your white lives too, that things were going to finally shift, that we were going to finally see justice served. And little did we know that it was a marketing ploy on behalf of many companies, including Target, that is now trying to dial back where George Floyd was killed. Imagine that. And entities, that, including those in the federal government, weren't going to push this for too long. And now they're trying to blame our focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion for why Democrats lost the election, because, you know, justice should not be served for the least of these. And here's what I take real issue with this particular executive memo. The people who will be hurt the most are the most vulnerable amongst us. They are the people who benefited greatly from a Trump check, right? From that stimulus payment, from a STEMI. They are the folks who thought that they would get a second chance in this administration because that check meant so much. I understand it, but now some of the things that you rely on every single day to keep your lights on are now in harm's way. So what they say in the next part of this memo is that each agency must complete a comprehensive analysis of all of their federal financial assistance programs. They're requiring a temporary pause on all activities related to obligation or disbursement of all federal financial assistance. That means they're not cutting no checks right now. It's a temporary pause that was effective as of yesterday at 5 p.m. I'm sorry, today at 5 p.m. And it is in effect until February 10th. So there may be things that you're waiting on. Maybe you were approved for a federal grant. Maybe you were approved for an SBA loan. Depending on the criteria of that grant or loan, you could be in harm's way. So that is what I want to flag for you. Lolo, text me if there are any questions that come up along the way. Now, The other thing that I think is highly dangerous is it says in the paragraph, this is the second page, this is the paragraph right above the bottom. It says that OMB may grant exceptions, allowing federal agencies to issue new awards or take other actions on a case-by-case basis. What does that mean? That means that it is solely up to their discretion. That means that it is a super subjective standard. And the folks who rely on agency funding because they are one of a few, because they are a woman-owned business or a minority-owned business, or doing work that would impact Black maternal health, or some of the things, some of my most important work that I'm the most proud of on Capitol Hill was helping to advance centers of excellence at HBCUs when I worked for the wonderful Congressman Thompson on the Homeland Security Committee. That funding is now all at risk, right? There are centers of excellence in all types of industry and spaces and different interests. All of that is at risk. A lot of folks have been saying, we were just talking on our pre-production call before we started about whether or not SNAP benefits, those EBT cards that folks use to buy food at the stores and to keep groceries, you know, in their homes, whether or not school lunches for kids would be impacted, whether or not affordable housing would be impacted. Well, here's the thing. This memo is super vague, talking about Marxist equity and Green New Deal social engineering policies and all of that with intention. And some of you may be saying, well, how is this even legal, right? Like, the executive branch doesn't necessarily get to govern what is funded, because the United States House and the Congress, why is this? Oh, there it is. The United States House and Congress writ large has the obligation of controlling the purse strings. Let's go to why you all are saying that. In Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7, called the Appropriations Clause in the Constitution, states in pertinent part, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. Now, this is about governing what is contained in the United States Treasury. Nothing can be paid out of the Treasury, according to the Supreme Court, then, let's see if they hold it now, no money can be paid out of the Treasury unless it has been appropriated by an act of Congress. Now, Donald Trump's administration is arguing something very interesting here. They are arguing that there may be a limitation on what can be spent. That is Congress's role. But that they can cut like there ain't no tomorrow under a doctrine that they call impoundment. So this means that they have control over cuts, but they don't have control of the spend of the purse strings. That is very, very dangerous. And it sounds like Donald Trump's administration is going to go hard to try to push this doctrine all the way to a court battle to the Supreme Court. Now, this Supreme Court, the same one that decided that Donald Trump could not be civilly or criminally liable as a president, that he had civil and criminal immunity, sides with them on they can cut whatever they want as the executive branch, but they can't spend whatever they want. Y'all, we in danger. And that's what we really need to understand. This is a very, very serious memo. This current acting OMB director is pushing to broaden its authority and to ensure that the only people that can make these decisions about a federal spend are Donald Trump's political appointees. And here's what I think is scariest about this, you guys. None of this is surprising if you read Project 2025. We have got to stay informed. Y'all, we can't keep getting caught on our heels about what's to come, because people are not informed. We have to be informed. Yes, it is a 922-page document. Yes, it is imperative that you read it. Yes, you need to know that many of the people who Donald Trump has put in critical roles, including Stephen Miller, which again, I would argue is running the White House, from the immigration, ICE raids, to all of the attacks on DEI. All of that is Stephen Miller's brainchild. That's not Donald Trump's thoughts. That is Stephen Miller. And he had to have him back in the White House because there's no ability for Donald Trump to think this way without Stephen Miller. He basically has ceded his entire presidency to Stephen Miller. That is a very dangerous thing. If you look up who Stephen Miller is, you'll understand why. So here is the other piece of this. You will also note that when you thumb through Project 25 and you see who wrote these pieces, you're going to recognize some of the names. I challenge you all to take Project 2025, the document, just the table of contents, and who wrote each chapter, and compare those names to who Donald Trump has nominated for positions in his cabinet and has put into the White House to work for him. You all will see a surprising number of similarities. And if you can see those similarities, you can go into those chapters and see that the executive orders and actions that have come out of this administration so far are no surprise at all. So those are the kinds of things that we need to be paying attention to right now. If you all don't have questions about Project 2025 and this federal funding freeze, then I'll go on to another executive order. Okay, Lolo sent me this. How does this freeze impact state level programs? Well, everything in every single agency is under review, from the United States Department of Agriculture, the Department of Energy, USAID, because they talked about a global spend as well, the State Department, which oversees USAID, the Department of Commerce. Y'all remember the Minority Business Development Agency was challenged on its merits just last year. Department of Treasury, every single governmental agency, SBA, for those of you who have small business administration loans that you may have just qualified for, at risk, the Department of Transportation. We have, you guys know, if you go into your airports at home, you're seeing a lot of construction. It is annoying, but we'll all be happy when it's done. There are these projects, these highways that are being built. Any DBE, disadvantaged business enterprise, that is working on those projects, that's all under review now, right? Depending on the grants and the loans that have been let. So everything is on the chopping block because of this very vague memo. And we need to be mindful of that. That is what is at stake. Somebody asked how this can be legal. I kind of just went through that. Hopefully what I've said makes sense. I will go through a little more just to backtrack a little bit on OMB. Some of you all might be like, I didn't get here in time. What is OMB? It's the Office of Management and Budget. Its responsibility is to prepare every year. Presidents introduce a budget. So you guys will see, if for those of you who work on the Hill, you see those huge binders. When I worked on the Hill, we used to divide up the sections and be responsible for a section and analyze the various sections of the president's budget. Well, they send this huge document over by agency, line by line, how much money they're going to fund the federal government. The OMB director is responsible for pulling that fiscal year budget together and dispersing it to the Hill for approval through the appropriations process. They also oversee the implementation of the president's priorities across the executive branch. Most of the time, what we've said on the Hill is you can tell what the president's priorities are based on how they choose to fund the federal government. After we receive the budget, the Hill, Congress, the House is responsible for passing appropriations measures. That has to be signed off or also passed in the Senate. Sometimes they don't agree. And so there has to be what was called a reconciliation process. And then the agencies are funded based on what is appropriated. Now, again, what I was saying earlier is they are challenging the president's authority to cut. I think they're acknowledging on the spend that has to go through Congress. Again, be clear about the fact that most of Congress has bought into this president's agenda. So those of you who are like, well, it looks like SNAP benefits or the EBT cards might not be impacted, or kids' school lunches might not be impacted. What I would challenge you with is every single year, Republicans go after SNAP benefits. They try to cut them. I call the Congressional Black Caucus, and they are known to be the conscience of the Congress. Every year, that's a fight that they fight to ensure protection of those benefits. So that is what is at stake. And then you guys are asking what to do. The most important thing that I will give you right now is make sure you are reading. If we are reading ahead, I know it's stressful to be seeing all of these changes. You may have folks who've been impacted by the ICE raids. You may have folks who you know just qualified for a federal loan who you're like, I don't know if they're going to get to keep that money, or a grant, a research grant at a university, right? That is so scary. But we cannot bury ourselves in fear. We have to stay alert. And the most important way we can do that is by reading what's in front of us. Project 2025, been written. Heritage Foundation, been on this for years and years and years. Go and look. When you see the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and we hear about fiscal conservatism, that is what it is. It is about finding ways to cut corners so that they can ensure the rich keep their tax cuts, right? They don't ever have the money to increase minimum wage. They don't ever have the money to ensure that kids can have summer jobs. They don't ever have the money to ensure that centers of excellence are fully funded, or HBCUs and Hispanic serving institutions and the institutions, tribal colleges, ever have the money that they deserve. But they can always find that dollar for war and for tax cuts. And that's what we're up against right now. So I implore you to read Project 2025. I implore you to pay attention to these memos. Don't just take in the executive orders and actions that are coming out. Don't just take my word for it. Read it yourself. In the last paragraph of this memo, it talks about agencies having a responsibility to look into each financial assistance program in these three ways. Assign responsibility and oversight to a senior political appointee. Again, we know that that means that person thinks like Donald Trump. They are so concerned about career employees, federal government employees, that they haven't found you yet. I implore you to stay and make sure that you are serving the people as you know it is your obligation to do. You might not have had to take an oath, but we have to make sure that we keep people in place who will tell the truth about what this administration is doing. We need whistleblowers to talk about everything that is happening so that we can better prepare. The second thing it says is review currently pending federal financial assistance announcements to ensure administration priorities are addressed and subject to program statutory authority. Modify announcements, withdraw any announcements already published, and to the extent permissible by law, cancel awards already awarded if they are in conflict with this administration's priorities. Now, that may not be legal, but it first has to be challenged. So right now, what this says is the law of the land until it is challenged and until a federal court agrees with the more reasonable minds among us. And last, it says ensure adequate oversight of federal financial assistance programs. Initiate investigations when warranted to identify underperforming recipients and address identified issues up to and including cancellation of awards. Y'all, they put us on notice. They put us on notice that as of 5 p.m. today, everything that the federal government funds that is under these very, you know, ridiculous buckets, you know, wokeness and trans, the words that they use to make the American people afraid, transgenderism, Marxist equity, everything that they can squeeze into these buckets, they will. And that is to create more funding capacity for the rich. So, people are asking about what the courts can do. Yes, this has to be challenged in court. And for the person that said it's just an audit, it is far more than an audit, my friend. These programs are being frozen. The funds are not going to go out. They say in here that they are trying to find if any programs that fit in those buckets that I've named, the wokeness, Marxist equity, transgenderism, Green New Deal, all of those are subject to cancellation. Why? Because they don't fit in with the current administration's priorities. That is the language and the framework that they will use to cancel the programs. So for those of you who work in the federal government, for those of you who have federal funding, I am suggesting that you figure out a way to ensure that your programs do not fall within that framework. So if you are advancing opportunities for the underserved, you better find some new language. If you are ensuring that the climate is safe and that climate change doesn't completely take us out, you better find some new language. These people ain't come to play. And they told us what they were going to do in a whole 922-page manual. So we got to get on it. Well, I've been on for 25 minutes. That went on pretty quickly. And that doesn't leave me any time to go through these executive orders. What I would urge you to do is make sure that you subscribe. This content will be just for subscribers soon. And then if you don't follow us on social media, make sure you do at Native Land Pod. Native Land Pod has information on other executive orders. We're going to keep you informed. As we get information, we'll share it. What we don't know, we'll tell you we don't know. Again, I don't know if SNAP or some of these housing programs will be impacted, but I promise you we'll be following it closely. We have your back. You all know. Within NLP, we say all the time, welcome home, and we mean that. This is your safe space. It's a safe space for us. We thank you for giving us that safe space. And what I can tell you is you are not alone. We are in this together, and we will get through it. Our people have experienced so much more difficulty in the past, and we don't want to go back. We know we don't want to go back. Many of us voted to not go back. But this is where we are now. We've got to accept where we are in order to change it. So let's get to work. Our first obligation is to stay informed, and whatever ideas you come up with, share them with us. We take videos for our shows every week. I would encourage you, if you have questions about the executive orders or this memo that came from OMB, send those in. Lolo takes them on DM at Native Land Pod. We'll get those videos. Tell us your name and where you're from. We'll get them uploaded for our show tomorrow that we record that drops on Thursday. Please, please, please stay in the loop with us. We want to hear from you. Our platform is yours too. And we can't wait to hear from you all. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for all of your questions. And please let me know if there's any other questions you have. I know we only got to one executive order. I'm sorry, but I had so much to say. And this was a new one. So there are others coming. If you guys want to keep hearing this content and keep engaging in this way, we will do that. So thank you so much for tuning in. Welcome home, y'all. We'll see you Thursday.
From KUT and KUTX Studios. From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
The question is asked of me as of you in different ways. And I am quick to say that I don't feel we should go around saying, as many do, that, you know, it's worse than it ever was and this and that and the other, because that's simply not true. I think that the more near the truth is that we have come a long way since the 60s or the 40s or the 30s or whatever. Longer, the further back you go, the longer way we have come. But that equally clearly we should say we yet have a long way to go. And I think that's where it is. We're in some interim stage and state. I don't know exactly where along the way it is, and neither do you. Nobody does. But we have come a long way.
I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late Alex Palmer Haley in Black America.
It was mostly having begun, and then the more you got, the more deeply you got into it, you were kind of in a position that if you didn't go on, you may as well never have started. You know, you just have such an incremental investment. And also the challenge, you know, you are really kind of at that time fighting a bit of a battle with yourself as to whether or not you've done something worthwhile or something dumb or whatever. And I was frequently having people say to me how dumb this whole thing was. You know, there were people who said that, for one thing, I guess I heard most frequently of all, would come from black scholars who happened to, I would go talking with them about it for one another reason. And a great many of them had the view of, what do you want to resurrect slavery for? And it got to the point that I really quit talking too much about what I was doing. And it was principally a personal challenge to see how far could I go with it.
Alex Haley served in the Coast Guard during World War II, the Korean conflict, and the Cold War. He was the first African-American Coast Guardman in the modern era to reach the rank of Chief Petty Officer. He paved the way for other African-American men and women to rise into the senior enlisted ranks in the naval services. Haley also holds the distinction of being the first Coast Guardsman to be distinguished in the specialty rank of journalist. In recognition of his able service to the Coast Guards and Naval Public Affairs and History programs. This was a significant position of responsibility for shaping the public image of the Coast Guard and reporting news within the service. And it broke the previous tradition of African-American sailors serving almost exclusively in menial jobs as cooks and stewards. Haley began his writing career with assignment with Reader's Digest and Playboy magazine, where he conducted interviews. During this time, he met Malcolm X, then the spokesperson for Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam. Later, he was asked by Malcolm X to write his life story. The result of that collaboration, the autobiography of Malcolm X, was published in 1965 and sold 6 million copies. Haley was born on August 11, 1921, in Ithaca, New York. Soon after his birth, he moved to Henning, Tennessee. At the age of 15, he graduated from high school and entered Alcorn State University in Mississippi for 2 years. His father persuaded him to join the Coast Guard. He enlisted in 1939. In January 1977, for 8 consecutive nights, 130 million viewers watched the groundbreaking, history-making saga of an American family who did not come over on the Mayflower or pass through Ellis Island. Roots, the story of Kunta Kinte, a West African enslaved in this country, and his descendant captivated the American television audience as no other dramatic program had done before. In February 1988, on a visit to Central Texas, In Black America spoke with Alex Haley.
Well, a whole variety of things. I have spoken a lot. I have fought the battle of correspondence as best I can, and simply to say that, you know, you get so much mail that comes from people asking things which are very, very personal to them, and I'm very close to my mail, and I hate not to respond to letters, so I try my best to answer as much as I can and still don't do probably half of it. And then I have written some, enough that I'm about, at this time, about 2 weeks away from finishing my next book, the book which will be titled Henning, which is the name of my little hometown in Tennessee. And it should be turned in to the publishers about 4 weeks from now, after I've been able to do 2 weeks' work on it.
I recently returned from Africa, and I got a very good feeling when I got to Senegal and had an opportunity to go to Gori Island and see the slave house. When you went back and doing the research for Roots, what type of an emotional feeling did you feel going back to Africa?
Well, you know, you're kind of in awe, really, if you know the full significance of where you are when you're at Goree. But let me tell you something about you. I was thinking when I walked in that door, I guess you did get an emotional feeling, because if you're around tribes in Africa enough, you get to sort of get some general feeling about tribal configurations, you know, face and all that. And I would bet you, if anything, that if it were possible, you could trace yourself back to your Kunta Kinte. I'll bet you anything, you came from the Wolof tribe. You look like a Wolof.
That's what they told me when I was in Dakar.
I know a village, they wouldn't know you left home. That's the truth. You really do have very, very clear Wolof features.
When researching Roots, what gave you the inspiration and the energy to undertake such a difficult task?
Well, it was mostly having begun, and then the more you got, the more deeply you got into it, you were kind of in a position that if you didn't go on, you may as well never have started. You know, you just have such an incremental investment. And also the challenge, you know, you are really kind of at that time fighting a bit of a battle with yourself as to whether or not you've done something worthwhile or something dumb or whatever. And I was frequently having people say to me how dumb this whole thing was. You know, there were people who said that, for one thing, I guess I heard most frequently of all, would come from black scholars who happened to, I would go talking with them about it for one another reason. And a great many of them had the view of, what do you want to resurrect slavery for? And it got to the point that I really quit talking too much about what I was doing. And it was principally a personal challenge to see how far could I go with it. I was astounded that I had been able to get as far as I did at certain points, because it really all had begun with stories told on the front porch of the living room by my grandmother and her sisters about the family. And you know my brother George. George was about 2 years old when I first heard the story of the family going back to the person whom they called, quote, the African, who said his name was Kente. And that meant about as much as, you know, as nothing to me in one sense. And those stories which they told about the family in my mind were sort of corollary to another set of stories I heard in a different locale, and that was biblical parables, you know, mm-hmm. like you. Where are you from? Really, I mean, natively.
Right. Namely from Detroit.
Oh, Lord. Well, anyway, I guess you all had Sunday school in Detroit, too,
yes,
but we sure did in Tennessee. But, you know, you tend to learn these things early. And I often think about it, and I sometimes say when talking that I guess when I was about 11 years old, by that time my head was a jumble of stories that I had heard from adults from one another locale. And it was kind of mixed up, like I would, you know, Chicken George and David and Goliath and Miss Kizzy and Moses. They were all kind of mixed up in there. And I would have had to stop and think about where some of them came from.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message.
Support comes from Austin Water. Residents and businesses can take steps now to prepare for the possibility of severe and freezing temperatures by having emergency supplies like water and insulation for pipes. More winter preparedness tips at austinwater.org.
And now back to this episode of In Black America.
And in that way, six sisters gathered who had not seen each other since they were girls. They were now, with one exception, all grandmothers, like my grandmother. They all began to act in ways I can remember so vividly. As I say, they hadn't seen each other in all these years. And they used to, at times, right there in the house, particularly during the mornings, any two of them would walk up to each other and just kind of stand and look at each other. And then they would put hands on each other's shoulders and just kind of shake each other and just laugh. They were so happy to see each other again after all these years. And then it would generally be in the evening, after supper, as we call it, and you do too here, the evening meal. They would wash the dishes, and they would kind of filter out onto the front porch. In time terms, it would be about as dusk deepened into early night. There were lots of honeysuckle vines right outside the porch. And there were, you know what, lightning bugs? They had lightning bugs all over the honeysuckles. And you know how honeysuckle vines smell, that thick, sweet smell. Just early dark, and there were lots of rocking chairs on the front porch. And anybody, any of the ladies sat in any chair except nobody but Grandma sat in her white wicker rocking chair. And I always stood right behind her chair. It seemed to me I should be close to Grandma. I always had the little boy feeling I should protect her since Grandpa was gone. And the first thing, it sounds sort of crazy, but I remember it so well. It seemed that the first thing was they had to get all the rocking together. You know, some people have a quick rock, and others have a sort of slow, languid rock. And they'd have to get these chairs synchronized the way they move. And then I remember so well sitting there, they would all start running their hands down in the apron pocket and coming up with these little shiny tin cans of Sweet Garrett snuff. And they would load up these lower lips. And after a while, they'd take these little practice shots. And
easily the champion in that department was my great aunt Liz, who had come in from somewhere called Okmulgee, Oklahoma. And Aunt Liz could drop a lightning bug at 6 yards when she got there, you know. And once they got everything settled, the rocking and the snuff, they would just start talking. And our little boy was sitting there listening. And night after night after night, in no given order, but just sort of mixing it around, talking bit of this and a bit of that, they would talk about the family. They seemed to have nothing that interested them as much as the history of their own family, although nobody thought of it as formal terms as history. They were just talking about their own family. They talked about their father and mother, Tom Murray, a blacksmith, and his wife, Irene. And then they talked about the plantation in Alamance County, North Carolina, where they had lived and where their father and mother had been slaves. And they talked about old Massa and old Mrs. Murray who had owned them. And I remember as a little boy, it just sort of struck me as funny, although I didn't say anything. Kids never, you didn't say anything then. Older people talking, you kept your mouth shut. But I would wonder to myself, it was so funny about somebody owning somebody. It just didn't sound right. And then they would talk. They would start sometimes shaking their heads and make remarks like, oh, he was just scandalous. And that was a preface to start to talk about the deeds of all sorts of daring do and something they used to call, sounded terrible, called womanizing and so forth. And they were talking about their grandfather, somebody called Chicken George, and used to fight gamecocks. And then they would on occasion talk about his mother, who was very quiet. They said never had a whole lot to say, but when she would talk, people listened closely. And her name, they called her Miss Kizzy. And then they would talk about Miss Kizzy's father. And when they got to him, it was almost like he was some character out of mythology. He was different from the others. And they did not know a great deal about him. And they talked almost hushed about him. He was somebody they called the African, who said his name was Kinte. And the whole thing was just talked back and forth and in and out. And that was how, as a little boy, from, say, the ages of 6 or 5 through, say, 10, every summer, the first summer was the only time all 6 sisters came, but every other summer, some number of those sisters would come, and every summer they would talk about it. And I learned the stories of their family very much as I learned the stories of the biblical parables, which I heard in Sunday school. Henning, Tennessee was the kind of Bible Belt southern town that, black or white, in that town, you were either Methodist, Baptist, or a sinner. That was the way people saw you. And every child went to Sunday school. And in Sunday school, you learned the stories so that I would say by the time I was 10, my head in story terms was a jumble of things like David and Goliath and Chicken George and Moses, and they were all mixed up together. And I would have had to stop and consciously think about it to figure who belonged in which group. And thus I learned, in the way that people, we all best learn something when we are young. Now, an illustration of that, I'm sure some of you have had this experience. I certainly have a great deal. If you're talking with very elderly people, so frequently, you'll come into situations in your own family or others where they may not be too clear on what happened last week. But they can tell you exactly what happened when they were 8 years old, 9, and so forth, you know? And the reason for that is because people's, all of our minds tend better to retain that which came into those minds early, before there was a lot of competition for so many things to know. And that was how the story became so entrenched for me. I grew on up, went to school some. My father was a college professor. And it is nowadays a lot is made about I went through this school and that school and did so well. I didn't do all that well at all. I made C's, C minus, and the reason I went into service, to tell you the truth, was that when I was a sophomore in college, I was at Alcorn in Mississippi, and I made a D in French. And that, in my father, he was a college professor, as I say, in his eyes, that was more than the family's honor could stand. And that... That was the summer he began to speak to me about how much he had enjoyed the Army in World War I. And so he recommended I go into service. His plan B one that I stay one hitch 3 years. Then he said I would mature, and then I could come back and finish college, get a master's, get a PhD, and be a college professor and be decent like he was. That was the way they had saw it. And he didn't have any plan, nor did I, but I wound up finally spending 20 years in the service. I loved it. I loved being a sailor and traveling all over and doing the things sailors did. And I was a cook. And during the days, I would cook all day, and then at sea, there was nothing to do at night. And that was how, purely by accident, I began to write. Literally how I got stumbled into being a writer, which I never had even thought about, was I used to write lots and lots of letters, and my shipmates knew I did. And when we would go ashore in foreign lands, like it was Australia and New Zealand, guys would meet girls, the ship goes back out to sea, everybody's talking about girls. They wanted to write letters to them. A lot of the guys just couldn't write letters. But they knew I wrote lots of letters, and they began to ask me if I'd help write love letters for them. And I began to do it. I would interview them at night. They'd line up, and I would say, what was it, you know? And literally, that's the way I stumbled into writing. And most of the guys were white, and they'd tell me, I'd ask them this, that, the other about the girl, and then say, like, if a guy told me the girl's hair was blonde. Well, out in the middle of the ocean, I'd get in some fit of creativity and come up with something like, your hair is like the moonlight reflected on the rippling waves. And every night, there'd be a bunch of guys carefully copying in their own handwriting this stuff. And they would give me a dollar a letter. And I began to do pretty well. And that was literally what gave me the first concept that there was something in the writing business. And that was what started me on that long, long road that most writers trod or tread. I wrote every night, I believe, for 8 years before I sold something to a magazine, a little piece. And then I was, sold on the idea of trying to be a writer. And I stayed in the service and finally was selling to magazines. Came out of the service, began to work for Reader's Digest, then went to Playboy, where I wrote the interviews, and one of them was Malcolm X. That led to the book about him. And then when that was finished, I, out of curiosity about the story I'd heard as a boy, just got to thinking about it. And one day in Washington, I went in the archives and asked for the census record of Alamance County, North Carolina, 1870. Having learned somewhere in the interim that the first time black people were named in the census was after the Civil War, and remembering the word Alamance County, much as you might remember Jerusalem or Galilee from having heard it as a child in Sunday school so much that it's just become a fixed part of you. And I got that census, and turning the crank, looking at the names of all these people long gone, and about the sixth roll of microfilm, it just sort of came up through the scope, the names of the family that had been talked about on the front porch, and that just galvanized me. And it wasn't that I had not believed my grandma. You did not believe my grandma. But there was something about seeing on microfilm in the United States National Archives the very things Grandma Aunt Liz, Aunt Georgia, Aunt Plus, all had talked about, that just fascinated me, and I began the long research that would ultimately take up 9 years of research and 3 years of writing. Not done with any sense of, as I say, great nobility, and I shall go forward and do this. I was just hung up with it, and I just wanted to tell it. And at some point in the process, I began to become aware that what I was really dealing with was not so much my family story as it was the symbolic story of a people. Because all of us who are what we call black people have fundamentally the same basic background story. Be assured that you too have a Kunta Kinte, or female equivalent, who was born and reared somewhere in some West African village, who at some point along the way was captured in some manner, was put in the hold of some slave ship, brought across the same ocean into some succession of plantations, and from that day to this struggled for freedom in its various forms. And that's the fundamental broad story of all of us.
When you finished the research and you put the manuscript together, did you receive any rejections from publishing houses when you initially tried to get the book published?
No, I didn't. You know, a funny thing is that story, I don't know if you heard it, but for quite a time, a story to that effect circulated rather widely that I had had a very hard time selling it. That's not true at all. The fact was that the publishers practically pulled it out of my typewriter because it had been sold before I finished it. The television rights had been sold, what is her name? Ruby Dee, the actress, Ruby Dee, Ozzy, you know, Ozzy's wife, heard me speaking about the research process. And then she met David Walper, the great producer. And David said something about he was looking for something generational of theme. So Ruby told him about what she had heard me talking about. And David came looking for me, which is sort of like, you know, the mountain Olympus comes to you. And
were you in awe when he called you?
I was in awe. You know, awe. I was. I don't know what the proper word is. I was beyond awe. Moreover, I remember I was in Jamaica in the West Indies because I didn't have enough money to stay here and work. It's cheaper there. Mm-hmm. And when he called me, he didn't call me. My manager called me, saying that David wanted to buy it, just as outright as that. And I really didn't have money enough to get back to this country. My manager had to send me fare. And so I came on back, and you know, and everything went beautifully. David turned out to be a magnificent guy to work with and learn from. And anyway, I did not have that problem at all of selling it. But rejection slips, I got in abundance in my, you know, early years of trying to be a writer. There were, from the time I started, I wrote every day. I was then in the U.S. Coast Guard, and I was writing on ships at night because I was a cook. By day, and I got 8 years of steady rejection slips before I sold the first thing, like almost any other writer.
You wrote the autobiography of Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. During my generation, it was must reading for all college students. How did you come to meet Malcolm Little, better known as Malcolm X, and to write his biography?
When I got out of the Coast Guard, I retired. You know, I was I had been in 20 years. I was 37. And the first magazine assignment that I got was from, surprisingly to me, the Reader's Digest, asked if I would do a piece about the organization known colloquially as the Black Muslims, or, you know, the Nation of Islam. And he, Malcolm, was the spokesman. So that was how I first met him. And then subsequently I began to do the interviews for Playboy magazine, and I interviewed him for that. Then a publishing editor, Ken McCormick, a venerable editor, read the Playboy interview and asked Malcolm if he would be willing to tell his life in book-length detail. And Malcolm demurred and, you know, about it. He finally agreed. And then he, Malcolm, asked me if I would write with him the book. And that's how that happened.
There's been generations removed from Malcolm X since his death. What kind of man was Malcolm X? Personally and professionally, as you know it.
Often I get asked that, as you would imagine. Usually I try, there's one word above all others. I just say the man was electrical. He really was. I have never known anybody before or since who generated the kind of excitement that he did just in his being and his persona. You know, he lived more than the average 10 men did in his 39 years. He was that, particularly professionally. And then personally, I guess he was also under a lot of pressure, a lot of nervous energy. It was hard for him to sit down like we are sitting. He would be pacing the floor. He was like a caged tiger all the time. He was, it seemed as if he challenged himself to do all that he possibly could do and then a little bit more, that type thing. And together with that, he had a, you know, a sentimental streak rarely seen, and little eccentricities, of course. One of them, I remember, he had, you know, when he was in prison, he said that he had almost forgotten in the streets all he had learned in school. So in prison, he decided he would, in effect, kind of re-educate himself.
The late Alex Murray Palmer Haley. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You're going to have previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org.
Thank you for listening. You are listening to Ebony Spectrum and In Black America here on WRCT Pittsburgh, WRCT.org.
Hey y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. Plane headed from Kansas collided with a military helicopter over Washington, D.C. 67 people died. There were no survivors. Passengers included top figure skaters from the U.S. and Russia, a young professor from Howard, a lawyer, and a young pilot. And you raggedy bitches blamed it on DEI? When discussing the crash, Trump cited old, outdated, and scientifically voided eugenics ideology when he said regarding the Federal Aviation Administration, we have a high standard. And there are things where you have to go by brain power. You have to go by psychological quality. That the various very powerful tests that we put to use to test employees were terminated by Biden. All this after generalizing Biden's diversity efforts by saying that he said FAA was too white. And it's clear to me, by the way, DEI is being weaponized in this current moment that the conservatives are trying to die on the hill that DEI is affirmative action hiring without any consideration of qualifications or fitness for a position. This is evidence again when just the day before the crash, 19 attorney generals sent a letter trying to bully Costco into abandoning DEI, warning them to stop their pushback after Costco has already said twice, girl, fuck you. In this letter, these attorney generals expressed the following: an urgency for Costco to end all unlawful discrimination imposed by the company through diversity, equity, and inclusion. Huh? That Costco should treat every person equally and based on their merit rather than based on devices.